The headlines this hour. Tehran says political divisions within the U.S. are preventing Washington from making political decisions in the Vienna talks, adding that should not result in the violation of Iran's rights. Iran unveils a new long-range ballistic missile capable of hitting targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers. Plus, Palestinians go on a general strike in the occupied West Bank to protest the killing of three more Palestinians by the Israeli regime forces. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Adi Shamkhani, says political divisions within the U.S. ruling establishment prevent Washington from making political decisions needed to advance the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna. In a Twitter post, Shamkhani said the U.S. government cannot make up for its domestic crises by violating the rights of the Iranian people. A few days ago, the U.S. granted a series of sanctions waivers to Iran. But now some Republican lawmakers are expressing outrage at Washington over that decision. In a classified testimony before Congress of U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, Republican lawmakers have called for a public hearing. They said the Biden administration has not been transparent about the process of his conduct regarding the JCPOA. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the accord in 2018, and now Tehran is calling for guarantees against any violations in the future. Our Vienna correspondent Homolesky says the political divisions regarding the JCPOA revival are not limited to the U.S. government and can even be traced within the country's negotiating team in the Austrian capital.
The eighth round has resumed. Yesterday we had a meeting between the heads of delegations of Iran and the European sides, and also the EU, basically EU coordinator Enrique Mora. Also there was a meeting after that later in the evening between the Iranians separately with the Russians and the Chinese. Today we're expecting more talks to be held. They haven't started just yet, but they are expected to be held later in the afternoon. Now, also yesterday, the Russian ambassador, Mr. Oyanov, after his meeting with the Iranians, had a separate meeting with the U.S. Special Representative Robert Malley, and said that in that meeting he'd discuss the prospects of the Vienna talks. And of course, this looking back at what's been happening in the U.S., what the Iranians and sources of the negotiations have been saying all along is that this is why they want the guarantees. The fact that there is a division clearly in America right now when the Biden administration is making decisions here. There are Republican lawmakers back home who are saying they are going to, clearly saying they're going to hamper implementation of a possible agreement. They are going to try and foil it. They are asking for Congress reviews and revisions, etc., etc., etc. So the Biden administration is under pressure there from the Republican side, facing a lot of opposition there. We even saw aspects of that division here in Vienna when two members of the Rob Malley team withdrew and they were replaced. One of them, Mr. Nephew, known as the architects of sanctions against Iran back in 2015. And all those seen as signs of divisions, not just between Democrats and Republicans, but also in the negotiating team itself here in Vienna.
Iran has unveiled a new long-range ballistic missile to mark the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The missile, dubbed Khaybar Shekhan, is able to hit targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint accuracy. It also can penetrate into missile shields with high maneuverability. The projectile is classified as the third generation of long-range missiles developed by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. In recent years, Iran has made great advances in its missile program, which it says is entirely defensive. Islamabad has asked the Taliban in Afghanistan not to allow their soil to be used by terrorists. This after at least five Pakistani soldiers lost their lives in a cross-border attack. As Kamran Yusuf reports from Islamabad, since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, there has been a surge in the militant attacks in Pakistan.
Pakistan has laid to rest its soldiers killed in a recent terrorist attack. Over the past 2 weeks, at least 22 Pakistani security officials and soldiers have lost their lives in multiple terrorist attacks. In one such attack along the Afghan border, At least 5 Pakistani soldiers were killed. Pakistan has blamed militants based in Afghanistan for the attacks. It has issued a strong statement urging the interim Afghan government not to allow militants to use the Afghan soil against Pakistan in the future. Pakistan has publicly condemned the use of Afghan soil for the first time since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan in August.
Afghan Taliban will have to rethink their position. They need to rethink how they think about the TTP, you know, because a terrorist outfit, if it continues to inflict terror, you know, wounds in Pakistan, will not be tolerated by Pakistan.
The Taliban government spokesperson has denied Pakistani allegations and insisted it has no evidence to suggest the recent attacks originated from the neighboring country. Pakistan hopes that cross-border as well as terrorist raids would end under the Taliban rule in Afghanistan, but the number of such attacks has gone up instead. This has raised concerns in Islamabad that the Afghan Taliban either does not have what it takes or is unwilling to act against militant groups. Back in November last year, a ceasefire was brokered between Islamabad and pro-Taliban militants based in Pakistan. But the truce ended with both sides accusing the other for not fulfilling their promises.
The doors for the negotiation can never be shut. But terrorists and those who raise arms against the Pakistan army and against Pakistan and attack our installations and our camps, they will not be forgiven.
Observers believe that Pakistan's relationship with the interim government in Afghanistan could come under serious stress if the cross-border militant attacks are continued. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters venting anger at Tuesday's killing of 3 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The clashes erupted as Palestinians were on a general strike in several occupied cities. Stores and businesses are also closed in the city of Nablus, where Israeli forces gunned down 3 people in a broad daylight. Resistance groups had called for the strike to protest the regime's nonstop crimes. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil. She says Palestinian resistance groups are calling for an international inquiry into the Israeli killing of 3 more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank.
A crime that was carried out yesterday in the city of Nablus when 3 Palestinian youths were killed by Israeli forces in cold blood. At the time, the Israeli soldiers or the Israeli regime had claimed that those 3 had been taking part in shootings against Israeli soldiers. Israeli forces raided Al-Makhfiyye neighborhood in day and killed those Palestinians while they were in their vehicle in cold blood. The Palestinian Authority, Palestinian government, as well as the different political and Islamic factions denounced the killing of those 3 Palestinian youths from the city of Nablus, describing what happened as an assassination. And the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs had called for an international inquiry and held the Israeli regime completely responsible for this crime because the Israeli soldiers didn't try to arrest those Palestinians. If it's true, as they claim, that they were taking part in shootings against Israeli soldiers at the numerous of checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, then they have a right to be at least arrested and investigated. However, there was a clear, order from the Israeli military establishment to kill those Palestinians in the spot.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says that Israel's drone operations over the Lebanese sky have considerably decreased since the resistance group activated its air defense system.
And for the first time, we are actually increasing the activities when it comes to the air defense system. Till now, we have great results. In the last 2 years, since we began this procedure, I can tell you and the viewers today that this Israeli activity has deteriorated or has decreased at a high level. We can see in the numbers, the number of drones that were before and after, for example, in the area of Bekaa, where we used to see on a daily basis, and in South Lebanon, as well, it has also decreased at a very high level.
In an interview with Iran's Al Alam TV, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah added that Hezbollah will use all sorts of weapons to counter Israeli threats. He underlined that Tel Aviv would not have hesitated for a moment to wage a war in Lebanon if the regime was certain about its victory over Hezbollah. Nasrallah stressed that the resistance movement has no fear of a war with Israel and will respond to its military offensives decisively. Russia denounces as provocative the reported Ukraine's request for anti-missile systems known as THAAD from the United States. Reactions came from Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov after a Russian media report said that Kiev had asked the U.S. to deploy several batteries of THAAD near the city of Kharkov. He said the Ukraine crisis will deteriorate further in case Washington supplies it with the missile systems. Ryabkov was also quoted as saying that such a U.S. move would narrow a political diplomatic solution to the crisis. The standoff between the U.S.-led NATO alliance and Russia over Ukraine is dragging on, despite a Russian call to settle the crisis through diplomacy. Moscow has warned that NATO could drag Europe into a war if it admits Ukraine as a member. The Kremlin has also demanded the military alliance to cut off its troops in eastern Ukraine.
The crisis between Russia and the West over Ukraine is far from over. French President Emmanuel Macron has visited Russia and Ukraine to de-escalate the rising tensions. French President has expressed hope that discussions with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin could lead to easing of tensions over Ukraine. Russia's President Putin, for his part, said Moscow and Paris share a common concern over the security situation in Europe. While acknowledging France's efforts at solving the security crisis in Europe, Putin also said his country's military buildup is conducted on its own soil, dismissing as baseless allegations that Russia is posing a threat to Ukraine. He warned that European countries will be drawn into a military conflict with Russia in case NATO admits Ukraine as a member.
Well, we see what they're after. They want to remain the player in Europe. What we have to see, and that's Putin and his meeting with Macron tells us about, that this is a European issue. And, you know, Europeans understand that Russia has a legitimate interest. That's what Macron said. That's what Germans understand. Every country has legitimate interests. Ukraine has legitimate interests. Germany has legitimate interests. But this is European affairs, and we are living in 21st century. They have to agree on how to solve it diplomatically.
Kremlin says President Putin did not give Macron a precise date for when Russian forces would leave Belarus after drills. Russia has begun deploying troops and military hardware to Ukraine's northern neighbor of Belarus for joint military drills. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has warned his country will go to war if Russia is attacked.
I think the threat of the war is not dangerous. Russians are not crazy and they wouldn't start the war. What they want to attract the world's attention to is the situation with NATO, whether this organization is honest, viable. What is it doing in Europe? What's its problems? And of course, United States and NATO, they don't want to revisit their kind of strange past and the very idea that they are not needed. So they prefer to concentrate attention of the world on the concrete situation with Ukraine rather than revisit what's happened after 1990.
Well, as far as Russia is concerned, the U.S. is not meeting two of its most important demands to end the standoff: preventing Ukraine's NATO membership, and scaling back the West's military presence in Eastern Europe. The U.S. has also threatened Russia with a punishing set of sanctions should it move to invade Ukraine. But the problem is Russia's retaliation against such sanctions, which can come at the expense of Europe, especially considering the continent's energy needs.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has said Europe is going through its most dangerous moment since the Cold War, At a security conference in Brussels, Borrell warned Europe faces the risk of a major military conflict on the continent. Russia has amassed an estimated 100,000 troops near Ukraine's border. It has demanded NATO to promise it will never allow Ukraine to join. Moscow also says other actions, such as stationing alliance troops in former Soviet bloc countries, must be curtailed. Russia has accused NATO of encroaching on its sphere of influence. It says NATO's addition of 14 new East European members since the end of Cold War is a threat to its security.
Why is NATO is expanding? Why is the West putting their, you know, kind of military bases all around Russia? They don't want to deal with it. So they use this opportunity, you know, two countries have different agenda. Russia wants to sit down with the West and discuss the future of NATO and discuss its own security and agree on something. So don't push closer to us.
Meanwhile, Washington has rejected those demands, but says it is willing to talk about arms control and confidence-building steps. The U.S. and its allies have ruled out defending Ukraine with military force, but say they would respond to any invasion with sanctions, arms shipments, and reinforcements of NATO countries nearby.
The United States is there pushing this wedge of Ukraine, pushing this wedge of, like, extremely Russophobic, you know, Baltic countries and Poland, and they don't want to remove NATO forces from Europe. They want to remain the key place in Europe. And, you know, as we remember, the NATO sort of idea is to keep Germany down and Russia out. And that's what sort of United States found the wonderful weapon for that. This is Ukraine and endless Ukrainian crisis. Ever since we remember there is a Ukrainian crisis.
Last week, Biden ordered nearly 3,000 troops to deploy in Poland and Romania to better protect NATO's eastern flank. A U.S. general arrived in Poland on Saturday, and the bulk of the new forces due there were expected on Monday.
In Colombia, rescue workers are struggling to find survivors who might be trapped under debris following a landslide. The landslide has buried several homes in a western town. At least 14 people have lost their lives and 35 others were wounded. Authorities are urging people to leave the area as there is still risk of further landslides. The disaster was triggered by heavy rainfall. Landslides are common in mountainous Colombia, especially during the rainy season. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Nothing better illustrates the cruelty and destructiveness of economic warfare than the current situation in Afghanistan, which is being subjected to the equivalent of a blockade because of the outcome of a war that the U.S. and its allies lost. The people of Afghanistan are now being starved because the U.S. and U.S.-led international institutions refuse to accept the reality of that defeat. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Daniel Larrison Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Economic Warfare is Killing Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. The economic war on Afghanistan is taking a deadly toll on the population as the country has been cut off from all but a trickle of humanitarian aid. Roughly 23 million people are facing acute food insecurity as a result, and that number is liable to grow if the international response remains as limited and piecemeal as it has been. Nothing better illustrates the cruelty and destructiveness of economic warfare than the current situation in Afghanistan, which is being subjected to the equivalent of a blockade because of the outcome of a war that the United States and its allies lost. The people of Afghanistan are now being starved because the U.S. and the U.S.-led international institutions refuse to accept the reality of that defeat. It is inexcusable that the same governments that kept Afghanistan so independent on external support for the last 20 years have yanked away that support when it is most needed for the Afghan people to survive and recover. It is incumbent on the U.S. and these institutions to alleviate the massive suffering that their policies are creating, as Esfandiar Batmanglij and Erika Moret explained in a recent article for Foreign Affairs. U.S. sanctions have combined with other cutoffs in funding to send Afghanistan into economic collapse. They said these measures, together with capital flight from the country and confusion over what is permitted under the UN and US sanctions against Taliban, has precipitated a major liquidity crisis and the collapse in the value of the Afghan currency, leading to sharp price increases in the import-dependent country. The collapse in Afghan purchasing power is so severe that the UN Development Program forecasts that 97% of Afghans could fall below the poverty line by the middle of 2022. As they make clear, it is no accident that sanctions are striking at Afghans' purchasing power, since this is what broad sanctions are designed to do. This economic weapon is hitting Afghanistan even harder than it has hit other countries because the country has practically nothing to fall back on, and that makes the use of it against Afghanistan even more outrageous. Broad sanctions always hurt the population much more than they damage the targeted government. It would be indefensible to starve a population to achieve regime change in any case. But collective punishment of the population never leads to the political and policy changes that sanctions advocates say they want. The Times of London quoted Mary Ellen McGroarty, country director of the World Food Program, WFP, in a recent report on the disastrous conditions, you cannot condition humanitarian support. This is a country where 75% of its budget was foreign assistance. If we don't send money, people will die. Should the children of Afghanistan starve? Is that punishing the Taliban? Besides sanctions relief, unfreezing Afghan government assets is critical to reviving the country's economy in the near term. As David Beasley, head of WFP, told Jane Ferguson earlier this year, if you unfreeze the money, then you can put liquidity back into the marketplace, and the economy will start to come back up. If you don't, we're not going to need to feed 22 or 23 million people per month. We are going to need to be feeding 35 million people. This country will absolutely collapse, unquote. In addition to the horrifying loss of life that would follow, this will also produce a massive refugee crisis that will place heavy strains on all of Afghanistan's neighbors, where hundreds of thousands of refugees have already fled. The Biden administration may be reluctant to take the necessary actions for fear of hawkish attacks that they are rewarding the Taliban, but they have to know that they will face these ingenuous hawkish attacks no matter what they do. The minimal aid that they are facilitating now is not nearly enough to address a humanitarian crisis as severe and extensive as this one. The crisis is bound to get worse if the economy does not get the infusion of cash that it needs to function, and it is largely within the U.S. government's power to make that happen. The Afghanistan case is a stark reminder that sanctions kill, and they can be more deadly than a military campaign. Broad sanctions are not a real alternative to war. They're simply another means of inflicting death and destruction on the targeted country because they are so damaging and indiscriminate. Broad sanctions should be rejected as an instrument of policy. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are discussing the 168th sermon where Imam Ali alayhi salam, which Imam Ali alayhi salam gave during the onset of the Battle of Siffin, and he started off by explaining about the covenant that we have towards acceptance of the prophethood, and where he also explains the status and the qualities and the characteristics of the true caliph of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Basically, he wanted to prepare them so that they are firm in their intentions and they remain steadfast, and so that they actually see that the duty of the true caliph and the true imam, the true leader, and how much he's supposed to be obeyed and followed because of that authority that has been given to him by God. So Imam Ali alayhi salam starts off with that. And then after that, he starts, he says, Usikum bi taqwallah, that I advise you to be pious. I advise you to be God-wary. I advise you to have what we call taqwa. Usikum bi taqwallah.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when explaining about the taqwa of Allah, وَسِيكُمْ بِتَقْوَى اللَّهِ, a person would be surprised that this sermon was given by Imam Ali alayhi salam at the start of a war. And you would be surprised that, okay, so is piety also something that is supposed to be there in the battlefield? Yes, definitely. Unlike some theories and some ideologies and worldviews of today that say that no, piety is just in the mosque or in the prayer niche, or you know, it is something very holy that only happens inside you know, the area where you pray, and out of that there is nothing called piety. This is an absolutely wrong understanding of reality. Rather, piety is something that is supposed to be there in everywhere, in every place, in every time, and it can show itself in and manifest itself in any dimension of a human being's life. So as I said, some people have limited piety and taqwa to the prayer niche or the prayer mat or the mosque, or for the Christians or the Jews, the churches and the synagogues, while this is not the case. Or to be pious means to have that, you know, pious appearance and, you know, that holy look on your face and things like that. That is what people think is piety, while they don't realize that piety is something beyond that. Piety and taqwa is that state that occurs in the heart and in the soul of a person. It is that state of the heart. It is that general, you can say, feeling that comes inside a person, that state of the heart and the soul inside a believer, within a believer, such that he never or she never goes towards sin. That state is something that blocks the person from sinning. It stops the person from sinning. That is that state called piety.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Some of the scholars compare piety to a vaccine. They say that piety is like a vaccination, against sins. So sometimes a person commits a sin and then tries to remove the sin, tries to ask forgiveness for the sin. But piety is something else. Piety is something, being pious, having taqwa is like having protection, having a certain force within you that stops you from sinning. And that force has to be created by yourself. It's not just going to come something from. It's something that you need to prepare within you so that the force is brought by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. A person is vaccinated. So a pious person is one who is actually vaccinated. And that is why when you talk about piety doesn't, when you talk about taqwa, the best translation for taqwa is not piety. Because piety, unfortunately, in our day-to-day conversations, means someone who prays, someone who fasts, who, you know, lowers his head and is humble and good and kind. That is what people think is piety. They don't understand that, you know, that taqwa is something that is applicable in all spheres of life. It manifests itself in different ways, in different forms, depending on what the person does. So sometimes piety, taqwa, is something that is supposed to be there against the enemy. There, piety means to lift the sword. It means to wear the armor. It means to dive inside the battlefield and fight against the enemies. That is taqwa in the battlefield. Taqwa in your work means that you are honest and truthful and you perform the transactions in the best way possible. That is taqwa in your transactions. Then there is piety in your social affairs, in your political affairs. All of these have taqwa, that you lead correctly, that you apply the right principles when it comes to leadership, when it comes to governing people, when it comes to interacting with people. Yes, and there is piety in your family also, with your family, with your wife, with your children, if it's a woman, with her husband. All of these are parts and parcel of piety. Unfortunately, people have limited piety to certain specific things that are very, very trivial. And they've forgotten that God has a plan for you, your whole life. God is not limited to a specific aspect of your life. No, He is there for you in totality. And you need to show that you are there for Him in totality, in every sphere possible. We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He grants us this form of piety. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Supreme Court on Monday, 7th of February, reinstated an Alabama congressional map that a lower court had said diluted the power of black voters, suggesting that the court was poised to become more skeptical of challengers to voting maps based on claims of race discrimination. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Liptak. The piece is titled, Supreme Court in 5-4 Vote Restores Alabama's Congressional Voting Map. In the United States, the Supreme Court on Monday reinstated an Alabama congressional map that a lower court had said diluted the power of black voters, suggesting that the court was poised to become more skeptical of challengers to voting maps based on claims of race discrimination. The vote was 5-4, with Chief Justice John Roberts joining the court's three liberal members in dissent. The Supreme Court's brief order, which included no reasoning, was provisional, staying a lower court decision while the case moves forward. The justices said they would hear Alabama's appeal of the lower court's ruling, but they did not say when. Both the stay and the decision to hear the case indicated that the court is open to weakening the role race may play in drawing voting districts for federal elections, setting up a major new test of the Voting Rights Act in a court that has gradually limited the reach of the law in other contexts. The dispute in Alabama is part of a pitched redistricting battle playing out across the country, with Democrats and Republicans alike challenging electoral districts as unlawful gerrymanders. Those challenges have mostly been filed in state courts, meaning the U.S. Supreme Court is unlikely to intervene. Civil rights leaders and some Democrats say the redistricting process often disadvantages growing minority communities, including African Americans and Hispanics. Republican state officials say the Constitution allows only a limited role for the consideration of race in drawing voting districts. If the court follows its usual practices, it will schedule arguments in the Alabama case for the fall and issue a decision months later, meaning that the 2022 midterm elections would be conducted using the challenge map. Alabama has 7 congressional districts and its voting age population is about 27% black. In the challenge map, black voters are in the majority in one district. The lower court, relying on the Voting Rights Act, had ordered the state legislature to create a second district in which black voters could elect a representative of their choice. In a concurring opinion on Monday, 7th of February, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, joined by Justice Samuel Alito, said that the stay order does not make or signal any change to voting rights law. It was necessary, he wrote, because the lower court had acted too soon before a coming election. When an election is close at hand, the rules of the road must be clear and settled, Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote. Late judicial tinkering with election laws can lead to disruption and to unanticipated and unfair consequences for candidates, political parties, and voters, among others. It is one thing for a state on its own to toy with its election laws close to a state's election, he wrote. But it is quite another thing for a federal court to swoop in and redo a state's election laws in the period close to an election. In dissent, Chief Justice John Roberts said the lower court in the Alabama case had properly applied existing law in an extensive opinion with no apparent errors for our correction. Still, he wrote, the Supreme Court's precedents have engendered considerable disagreement and uncertainty regarding the nature and contours of a vote dilution claim. The correct solution, the Chief Justice wrote, would have been to agree to hear the state's appeal, but not to grant a stay in the meantime. The practical effect of this approach, he wrote, would be that the 2022 election would take place in accord with the judgment of the district court. But subsequent elections would be governed by this court's decision on review. In a separate dissent, Justice Elena Kagan said the majority had gone badly astray. It does a disservice to the district court, which meticulously applied this court's long-standing voting rights precedent, she wrote. And most of all, it does a disservice to black Alabamians, who, under the precedent, have had their electoral power diminished in violation of a law this court once knew to buttress all of American democracy. Justice Elena Kagan added, the lower court had acted well before the next primary election in late May and the general election in November. Alabama is not entitled to keep violating black Alabamians' voting rights just because the court's order came down in the first month of an election year, she wrote. Justices Stephen Breyer and Sonia Sotomayor joined Justice Kagan's dissent. In earlier decisions, the Supreme Court effectively gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which had required federal approval of changes to state and local voting laws in parts of the country with a history of racial discrimination, and cut back on Section 2 of the law, limiting the ability of minority groups to challenge voting restrictions. The Alabama case also concerns Section 2 of the law, but in the context of redistricting. Section 2 bars any voting procedure that results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race. That happens, the provision goes on, when, based on the totality of the circumstances, racial minorities have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice. In November, Alabama's legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, redrew the state's 7-district congressional map to take account of the 2002 census. It maintained a single district in which black voters make up a majority. That district has long elected a Democrat, while the state's other 6 districts are represented by Republicans. After the map was challenged by black voters and advocacy groups, a unanimous 3-judge panel of the Federal District Court in Birmingham, Alabama, ruled last month that the legislature should have fashioned a 2nd district in which black voters either comprise a voting age majority or something quite close to it. The unsigned decision was joined by Judge Stanley Marcus, who ordinarily sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta, Georgia, and was appointed by President Bill Clinton, and by judges Anna Manasco and Terry Mora, both appointed by President Donald Trump. The panel found that voting in the state is racially polarized and that it will be possible to draw a 2nd reasonably configured district to allow black voters to elect their favored candidates. The panel ordered the legislature to submit new maps within 2 weeks and said it would appoint an independent expert to do so if the deadline was not met. Primary elections are scheduled for this May. Alabama officials asked the Supreme Court for an emergency stay. They said that the panel's ruling would result in massive disruption of the state's elections and that Alabamians will suffer the constitutional harm of being assigned to racially segregated districts. It will result, they wrote, in a map that can be drawn only by placing race first above race-neutral districting criteria, sorting and splitting voters across the state on the basis of race alone. The panel's ruling, they added, is premised on the noxious idea that redistricting begins and ends with racial considerations. In response, lawyers for Greater Birmingham Ministries the Alabama State Conference of the NAACP, and several voters said there was ample time and no risk of confusion. The primary is still over 4 months away, and the election itself over 10 months away, they wrote. No election has ever been held under the challenge plan, so there is no risk of voter confusion. In a separate response, lawyers for a second set of voters said that granting a stay would do a severe disservice to the public interest by rendering unlawful plans functionally immune from challenge during the first election of a redistricting cycle, signaling to states that they get a free pass on their plans so long as they delay enactment until it is too late for courts of law to provide relief. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful tradition just narrated from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam regarding charity. The theme of this tradition is that every kindly act, every friendly act, every act of kindness that one performs is actually considered an act of charity in the eyes of God. Right? It's not necessary for charity to be in the form of money that one gives to a poor person or a needy person, right? Or even food that one gives to somebody who's needy and worthy of it. Rather, charity can come in many other forms. This hadith begins in this way. The Prophet ﷺ says, "Verily, every single Muslim is to give in charity every single day." When asked who would be capable of such a thing, people ask the Prophet, "How can it be possible for a Muslim to give charity every single day?" The Prophet ﷺ replied, "Your removal of an obstacle from the road is a charitable act." The Prophet then begins to mention other things that can also be considered charity. It's not necessary for a person to give money every day. Right? If somebody would do that, he would become bankrupt very quickly. That's not necessary. A person can give other things, do other things, and reap the same reward as he would reap if he had given money in the path of God. He could remove an obstacle from the road. Let's say that there's a big rock on the road that, you know, if not removed, could hurt somebody. Removing that rock is a charitable act. You're guiding someone the way is a charitable act. Let's say that there's a blind person and he wants to cross the road. And there's an old person, an old woman, an old man. He wants to get to the other side of the road. Take his hand, lead him to the other side. This is an act of charity. Your visiting the sick is a charitable act. Let's say that somebody gets sick, right? Not necessarily bringing the sick person something to eat, some soup to help him get better. No, just visiting the person, meeting him, seeing him, you know, condoling him, you know, and wishing him that he gets better, this is a charitable act. Your enjoyment of good to others is a charitable act. Telling people to be good, enjoining, doing amr bil ma'ruf to them, you know, encouraging them to be good, to pray, to fast, this is an act of charity for them. You get the same reward as you would have if you had given some money to a poor person. Your forbidding others from wrongdoing is a charitable act. You know, doing nahi anil munkar, preventing them from sinning, telling them that this is what you're doing is wrong, you shouldn't sin, you should be good, this is also a charitable act. In the end of this tradition, the Prophet mentions a very easy act that all of us can do, and we can all get the reward of charity every day. The Prophet ﷺ says, "And you returning the greeting of peace is a charitable act." Raddu salam. If somebody says salam alaikum to you, replying to their salam, saying wa alaikum assalam to them, this is a charitable act, meaning you get the same reward that you would have gotten if you had given money on the path of God. So we can do these various things and get the same reward that we would have gotten if we would have given money on the path of God. And we should do this, as the Prophet said, that every single Muslim is to give charity every single day. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This month, like.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Membership at the AU, the African Union, has become a source of controversy.